Whenever you're ready, Counselor.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, as I've learned in my brief career as a prosecutor, it is a hard job. You are confronted with a welter of conflicting facts, and you must select who and whom and what to believe. And then you have to decide whom and what to charge. Then you have to decide how to gather the evidence. And then you have to decide, do you go to a preliminary hearing or to a grand jury? Throughout all of this, you have to rely very heavily on the police department. And you have to decide, and you have to depend on them to do most of the evidence gathering, most of the legwork, and you have to, as I say, rely on them. Through all of this, in the words of Ronald Reagan, you have to trust but verify. And that is what our office in this case was and is attempting to do. And it is made especially difficult when the police officer is both a victim and a witness. The obligation of a prosecutor as a minister of justice is to verify, to ensure that the prosecution is fair, to ensure that the evidence that the prosecutor believes should be presented is truthful. When a police officer is a witness and a victim, there is another interest at stake, and that is where the respondent and relator, I think, parted company, the public interest in the appearance of justice, in the appearance of fairness. When a police officer is a victim, it is a difficult situation for everyone concerned, and not the least the officer, but the prosecutor has a duty to assure the public that the officer who has, in a case where the officer has used force in making the arrest, that the officer's conduct was lawful and legitimate. And that requires the prosecutor to trust but verify. There are a variety of ways to do this. There is no easy answer. Various jurisdictions, I'm sure the court is aware, this is a very serious issue nationally. And there are various jurisdictions who have adopted various methods to approach this. Our office has evolved a process that relies on what I call the public integrity unit of the office to review the officer's conduct. And I might add that the police department operates somewhat in the same way. The police department has what is called in St. Louis a force investigation unit. And that is what our office relies on to review the legitimacy of the conduct of the officer, as well as the officer himself. In the prosecution, the attorneys who are assigned to prosecute the case rely on the officer. The other branch of the office relies on the force investigation unit to determine if the officer is, his version is verifiable. In this case, as it happens, and I should point out a very big frustration, and I think Judge Draper probably didn't have to experience this to the same degree we do now, but the police department, if the wheels of justice grind slowly, sometimes the force investigation unit grinds even slower. And in this particular case, it was about a year ago that this incident occurred and that the officer, whom we call AF in the record, was forced to use his weapon and seriously wound the defendant, Mr. Davis. And I might point out Mr. Davis, the intervener, is represented this morning by Ms. Erica Wurst, but we had agreed that we would not share argument, but she is here if the court felt the need to hear from the intervener. To go back to the circumstances, you know, this case was issued by our office against Mr. Davis, who was seriously wounded, and we wish to proceed because of issues that have been raised by police officers in the city of St. Louis, objecting to the manner in which our office handles these cases.
Does the officer have standing in this case to really object?
In our view, the officer did not have standing. I should jump ahead to the fact that, as I notified the court, we finally got the final reports from Force Investigation. First Assistant has finally concluded that Officer AF acted legitimately. We have notified the court and Mr. Milliken of that fact. We do not think that renders the case moot, because even though there is no standing of a witness to move to disqualify an attorney in a case absent a lawyer-client relationship between that witness and the attorney, Judge Boyer chose to act on his own inherent authority. And Mr. Milliken and the Attorney General, I think, have both functionally conceded that there is no standing in a witness to move to disqualify counsel. The problem is that Judge Boyer injected himself into this process and has told the relator what can and cannot be done in handling these cases.
Is the basis on which he acted independently and asserted inherent authority, is that mooted also?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it is, because I think that that's the very reason it is not moot. It is capable of repetition, yet evading review. Judge Boyer has sent a signal to the judiciary throughout the state that a prosecutor can and should be disqualified in a police officer use of force prosecution because there is a potential conflict and a, quote, appearance of impropriety, unquote. Now, both the Attorney General and Mr. Milliken and I all agree that LeMaster lays out a standard to be followed in evaluating whether there is a conflict and whether there is an appearance of impropriety, and that standard is an objective one. And if you look at the litany of complaints that Judge Boyer outlined in his opinion and on which Mr. Milliken relies, this is a catalog of proprieties that the respondent added up to an impropriety or an appearance of impropriety. We did not take this case to the grand jury. Well, no prosecutor is required to take anything to a grand jury, and indeed, there are very few jurisdictions in this state where a grand jury sits constantly. The complaint is that we're not transparent enough with the officer. Well, you know, I'm not sure what our obligation to the officer as a witness is, other than to treat him fairly, which is what we have been trying to do. And in fact, we have concluded that his testimony is reliable. We wish to proceed and present it, but Judge Boyer's order is standing in the way. And even if we thought the matter was moot because our office is now prepared to support the officer's testimony, that order still has to be undone. So I don't know that even on that ground it is.
And Judge Boyer hasn't vacated his order.
He has not. Of course, this court has prohibited him from taking any action in the premises, so I'm not sure he can do anything.
Normally
without,
it says
without
it'll
relief.
Accept vacating whatever order is the subject of the writ. Normally our writs say you can't do anything except vacate the order that's the subject of the writ. So presumably this did. I don't know that.
Assuming that he could, and I know
he has not.
I know in my former life, I think I would proceed warily in doing anything when a preliminary order had been granted. But notwithstanding, clearly, if it's moot, the order has to be vacated. But we don't think it's moot. We think that, in my letter to the court, I referred to the Pratt case, which involved the ill-advised public defender rule on refusing case appointments. I alluded to the budget cases out of this court where there are situations where it is a matter of significant public importance and where there is an answer that is urgently required. And I might emphasize that this is a uniquely appropriate situation for this court to provide guidance. This court superintends the bar. This court has a unique role in telling us what should we do in these situations? And I submit that the answer is that we should do what we've been doing.
So what test do we apply to decide if these reasons are proper ones or not? Given under LeMaster, if we're looking at the appearance of impropriety, the trial judge said these other things that created an appearance to him. How do we judge that? Under what standard?
Well, I think LeMaster, I don't think quote it verbatim, but the standards is, would a reasonable person, knowing all of the facts and circumstances, have a doubt about the fairness of the proceeding, the trial?
But would an objective observer have doubts,
correct,
basically?
It's an objective one. Mm-hmm. And I think, would an objective observer believe that it is improper for a prosecutor to review the testimony of any witness that is going to be proffered to a jury?
Which could arise in cases of co-defendants where there is a deal with one and not the other, and the co-defendant's going to be called to testify. I mean, it's not limited to the police officer scenario.
That's the other difficulty with Judge Boyer's approach, is that, yes, it cannot be limited to this particular situation. This is a different situation because of the atmosphere in which we live. You know, as I said below, and Mr. Milliken has tasked me with saying it, but it is different. But fundamentally, the rationale of Judge Boyer, you can't draw the line at, oh, it only applies to police officer witnesses. You know, Mr. Swingle aided me ably in the brief by pointing out, you know, this is where you have an assault case where both parties used force, the prosecutor has to make a judgment. And you have to look at the testimony. And as you go along, and that's one thing I've learned the hard way in the last 6 months, in the crucible of the adversary process, you know, you have to be looking at the testimony of all the witnesses critically. And I think that's the duty of the prosecutor. And I think in our case, we were doing our duty. Judge Boyer improvidently disqualified us. And as a matter of law, with all due respect to Judge Boyer, with whom I've had many interesting experiences, I think by making an error of law, he abused his discretion by definition. So we submit the writ should be granted made permanent, and that we should be allowed to proceed with this prosecution speedily in deference to Mr. Davis's speedy trial rights.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I want to definitely get into the facts of the underlying decision as to why Judge Boyer did what he did, but I figured I'd first just take the tough issue of standing directly on. I know that you asked about Judge Draper. In this case, I entered a limited entry of appearance. I did not seek to intervene in the case. I did not seek to become a party in the case. I didn't appeal any judgment in the case. I simply entered my appearance, my limited appearance, to protect the rights and interests of my client. No different than a lawyer would do in a motion to quash a subpoena or a motion for protective order.
And how are the rights and interests of your client affected by a case in which your client's not a party?
Because my client was put in a position by the actions of relator of making a decision of whether or not he would testify in the case while a shooting investigation was pending.
And how is that different than any other person who's a potential witness but could be an alternative perpetrator?
It's a good question. The difference is there's two differences. Number one, the Circuit Attorney's Office does not have a team of prosecutors and investigators investigating a witness or a victim in an assault case. They choose which horse to ride, and they ride it.
Well, he could take the fifth if he thought the question might incriminate him, and that's no different than any other witness who gets their deposition taken, having given a deposition before.
And that leads to me to my second point, is the difference here is that relator's past actions specifically that she has, in my mind, punished at least one other officer who was in the same position as this officer who did take the Fifth, that puts the officer in a position where he has to determine whether he's going to assert his constitutional right to remain silent and suffer the consequences of not of being put on an exclusionary list by the prosecuting attorney's office.
But again, I mean, and I truly understand the dilemma and the problem that you're talking about and why officers want to worry about that, but there's no legal distinction that I can see between your saying this and someone else saying I might lose my job if they find out I took the Fifth in a case or something else. How, as, and the objection, it seems to me, would be the vindictive action, if there was a vindictive action or something brought in a suit brought against you, as opposed to giving you standing in this case.
Again, not prosecutor's office is using the exclusion list as leverage to force this officer to try to testify while a shooting investigation is hanging over his head. That's the issue.
How would that be different if you had a special prosecutor?
Well, a special prosecutor could do a couple of things. In this case, he could or she could use the grand jury, for instance, to avoid this particular situation for now while the pending shooting investigation took place.
But you're, and what I'm getting to is you're assuming a special prosecutor would do anything differently than the circuit attorney's office would do. So it's something beyond simply you're saying there's some conflict or potential conflict. What if the special prosecutor decided to use a preliminary hearing, or there already is one, so they wouldn't need to, but what if they took the same position the circuit attorney did? Would then we need to recuse them? I'm unclear how that's the remedy for this problem, even though I understand your problem.
And I understand. It's a good question. I'm just assuming that a special prosecutor would follow the same practice and pattern that has been followed in the 22nd Judicial Circuit for years, in that they do not put victim cases in front of a preliminary hearing and expose them prematurely to cross-examination, especially while there's a pending shooting investigation hanging over that victim or witness's head. And so I'm assuming that that special prosecutor would use the grand jury just like it's normally done in the 22nd Judicial
Circuit. What about, in, say, some other place that doesn't use grand juries? How would?
Well, I can't speak on that issue. All I can speak on is the specific facts in this case. And the fact is that we are in the 22nd Judicial Circuit, and the kind of unprecedented nature of sending this victim case to the preliminary hearing, and Judge Boyer pointed this out in his order, that in the 12 months that he had been in Division 25, where preliminary hearings are heard, he had not seen one victim case, not one. And so I think that, in his mind, gave him suspicion as to what why the circuit attorney was doing this.
Don't prosecutors have absolute discretion on what cases they want to proceed by grand jury and what cases they want to proceed by preliminary hearing, or whether they want to proceed at all?
Absolutely.
How is this case any different than that?
There's no question that the prosecutors have that authority. Absolutely no question.
And they can decide who is called as a witness and who isn't. So they could have called the victim. Yep.
It seems like you're more claiming not that the something that's an appearance of impropriety or that's a potential conflict, but there was actual bias here that precluded a fair investigation. But that's not what you alleged, but that's more what you're saying.
I think what Judge Boyer did is he took all of the facts that he heard, all of the facts that he considered, that being one of them, the transfer from the grand jury where the case started, where all victim cases go, to the preliminary hearing. That's just one of the facts that I think he considered in coming to his conclusion. There are other facts that he also considered in reaching his decision. So it wasn't just the idea that I agree, Judge Fisher, the prosecuting attorney has absolute authority whether to send it to grand jury preliminary hearing. But the difference is we're talking about, is there an appearance of impropriety in this case because they went away from the traditional standard norm?
Impropriety against who, though?
I'm sorry?
Impropriety against who?
Against the prosecutor.
Impropriety by the prosecutor against who? Against whose interest?
Well, again, in this case, against the police officers.
Okay, but that's not the impropriety about which any of the cases speak. They're talking about the defendant's right to a fair trial, not the witness's or the victim's right to be treated as he or she wants.
I think what the cases talk about is an impropriety based on what a reasonable person would, how a reasonable person would see it. And so, I think, yes, this is an unusual situation. And I certainly, and I don't think Mr. Durker found any cases like this. But I think Judge Boyer applied the standard to the facts that he heard and considered in coming up with his ruling.
So these cases certainly should have come about many times over the years, but is the difference because now the prosecutor's office has this public integrity investigation as opposed to the police department investigating their own officers?
It came up based on a number of factors. Number one, I think, the fact that they are investigating and assign a team of prosecutors and investigators to investigate the same witness victim they're relying on is an inherent conflict. Do they believe them or not?
Well, don't we have screens?
How is that different than any co-defendant in any case?
Because
they have to decide when they go like this,
right?
They have to decide who they believe. And I assume sometimes they get it wrong.
And maybe they do.
But that's why we have judges and juries to decide these issues, right? The prosecutor just has to make the initial determination of what they think is true and the obligation to present what they think is true. And the law gives them absolute discretion.
And that's true. And once they make that decision, they move forward with the case. They don't have, again, a team of prosecutors and investigators still looking back at the conduct of that person.
So you'd say it'd be okay if they didn't have people doing that, if the individual prosecutor in the individual case still would, as Judge Fisher said, have to make a decision. Do I believe the officer? Do I believe the defendant? Do I believe some mix of the two? It sounds like here they've set up this separate unit and put up a screen to separate that from action. Wouldn't that be a protection as opposed, how is it an abuse of authority?
Which, well, first of all, that separate unit and screening process was not in place when this motion was filed and when the hearing took place. And you don't have to look further than the transcript to see that. And so that was another problem. We had attorneys who were investigating the officer and also taking place in grand jury proceedings, in preliminary hearing proceedings, or in trying to take part in depositions. And so that was another problem when I filed the motion. That was one of the issues. And now that has been remedied, and we're glad for that.
Okay.
We're glad that now there is a screening in place to keep that situation from taking place.
And that gets to, you notified this court recently that you believe that this case is now moot.
I believe that from the officer's perspective, certainly the case is moot. He's been cleared. He's going to testify no matter who and cooperate no matter who the prosecutor is. So the underlying reason for filing the motion, which was a conflict of interest, has now been resolved. Now, if the question still is, did Judge Boyer abuse his discretion, I think that's still an open question.
Well, I mean, your opposing counsel correctly notes that the real issue is the order still there. You note in your correspondence to this court that upon a respondent vacating and set aciding this order, this matter will be moot. But it has the respondent vacated this order?
No, and I talked to respondent about that, and he said that he didn't think he could at that point. Without,
he thinks he's being prohibited by this court.
That's correct.
Even though the writ specifically states, I pulled it up, that that he shall do nothing with this matter other than vacating your order dated January 25th, 2018, granting police officer AF's motion to disqualify the city attorney's office.
The order is, you're correct. He could have vacated at that point, and certainly I have no opposition to that.
So is it your view this court should wait and see if that order is vacated or wait for one of the parties to file a motion to vacate? Or is it you are asking the court to proceed because you think that this will be repeated and evade review, as opposing counsel suggested?
I filed this case based on the very specific facts. I don't believe it probably goes any further than that. So to me, I think once it's vacated, the case can proceed, and that'd be it. And if there's no questions, I would like to get Mr. Goodwin a chance to speak on behalf of the Attorney General's office.
Mr. Goodman, you have 2 minutes and 50 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I appreciate the court's indulgence. The Attorney General's position and desire to participate this morning at the request of the respondent is to answer Judge Stiss' question of how does this court review this case. Mm-hmm. The standard of review for this court reviewing the propriety of the respondent Boyer's action is whether Respondent Boyer abused his discretion. Now, what Respondent Boyer needed to do was to do the two-step burden-shifting analysis. At the first step of LeMasters, to consider any facts or issues that might create an appearance of impropriety. And once an appearance of impropriety was demonstrated, then the burden would shift back to the prosecutor to demonstrate countervailing facts that would dispel that appearance of impropriety, such as an effective screening process. So when this court reviews what Respondent Boyer did, it's whether Respondent Boyer's actions constituted an abuse of discretion at the time he made it.
Do you agree that there's no actual conflict in this case?
Your Honor,
based upon the judge's order, there's no actual conflict, correct?
When you say conflict, yes. There's sort of two reasons to disqualify a prosecutor. The first is a bias or a conflict with an individual prosecutor and a defendant. The other reason would be whether there's an appearance of impropriety.
And there's no basis in the judge's order that there's an actual conflict in this case.
Correct. Such that the judge's order is totally based on the idea that a reasonable person would perceive there to be some impropriety in the proceedings in this case.
And again, impropriety with respect to whom or what?
And that was about to be my next point, Your Honor. That's a very interesting question. All of the preceding cases, LeMasters and the earlier cases, talk about an impropriety towards the defendant. There's not a Missouri Supreme Court case with a factual scenario where, for instance, the prosecutor was prosecuting his best friend and, for instance, refused to give an opening statement and the case was dismissed. That kind of proceeding might create an appearance of impropriety.
But that's
right?
For one of the parties to the action, because that would be the impropriety, again, would be affecting a party to the action, not a witness.
Correct. And so that's a question about standing as opposed to a question about to whom the appearance of impropriety must flow. I think in my very limited time, this court has been clear that a court has an inherent authority and duty to supervise the proceedings and to make sure proceedings appear fair, and I think that's what Respondent Boyer did.
But have we ever said there's an inherent authority to disqualify a prosecutor?
There are cases that discuss that, yes.
No case has ever disqualified a prosecutor based upon who they decided to call as a witness.
That is correct, yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I would say that if Judge Boyer were to vacate his order, that would be no solution, or that would not be conclusive on the mootness, because that would be a party making it moot. There are cases that are skeptical of the situation, not that I'm impugning Judge Boyer's view that he'd like to get the thing undone, but I think the problem is that Judge Boyer's order, by its very existence, sent a very bad message, which is that police officer witnesses get to be treated differently insofar as who gets to review their conduct and what prosecutor has to be brought in. A special prosecutor, as I think the court has pointed out, would have the same duty that we have to review the conduct of the officer and decide if his testimony is truthful. And I would also say that with regard to the screening issue, yes, you know, at the time this was argued below, I was on the job for about a month, and there were a lot of things that were a work in progress. But I would point out that there is no screen that can be impermeable because of the constitutional obligation of prosecutors under Brady. If a special prosecutor concluded that the officer's testimony was false, he would have to disclose that. He would have to disclose that to us. and then we would have to prosecute the officer. You know, I think that the importance of this case is that in this context, we have a situation where a prosecutor has been disqualified, certainly at the initiation of a witness and a police officer witness, by a court that is sending a message that prosecutors, our office in particular, can't approach these kinds of cases the way that we are doing it. And I think that, you know, one last point I would like to make is some of the cases, at least there's one case on the books where my esteemed co-counsel, Mr. Swingle, was himself the victim and had disqualified himself and sought the appointment of a special prosecutor, and an issue grew out of that as to whether the special prosecutor could dismiss or re-indict. I think prosecutors have to face these issues, but I don't think that Judge Boyer has found any objective reason why there's an appearance of impropriety. And I would mention also that, unfortunately, we have a number of police shooting situations that have developed since this case, and we have taken at least one of those to a preliminary hearing. And I don't think that it's an appropriate exercise of the trial court's discretion to condemn us for electing between two perfectly proper procedures, particularly given public interest. I think sometimes the public has a right to know what's going on, and in the grand jury, they don't always know that. So I submit the writ should be granted, and we should be given guidance in this sensitive area.
Thank you.
Court.
Could I ask one question?
Sure.
Is the information of an exclusionary list in the record?
If you're referring to the recent published reports about an exclusionary list.
If that was referenced,
well,
by one of the
There is
attorneys.
In the record an allusion to Detective Nikoloff, who was found to have taken the Fifth Amendment in a prosecution in a police shooting case, and the circuit attorney notified the police department that we did not feel that he could be relied on in the future, and we would not prosecute based on cases that he would submit. And that happens to open up another can of worms that in both my current life and my about to become new life
I was asking because Mr. Milliken indicated there was a threat to the officer to be put on an exclusionary list, and I just wondered if that was part of the record.
Well, there is in the record an indication that we had that situation, yes.
Thank you.
I thought there was no list in existence until after this case was, the order was already issued by Boyer. There was no actual list at the time this case existed.
That's correct, Your Honor.
It's not in this record.
That's correct.
Maybe in the newspaper.
Yeah, we may. I'm not sure what hat I'll be wearing the next time I see you, but that could be coming.
Thank you.